great Irish tunes as we celebrate, indeed, Irish Heritage Month across the United States. There's, you know, this is a place, friends, you should tune into if you're thinking of or if you want to get news. And we have big news because our first guest this morning just became a grandma yesterday. Yes. And so let's, and this for the first time. So let's go to Christine Keneally, of course, who Christine, as we know, is indeed the director, the founding director of that, of Ireland's Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac University. Well, Christine, congratulations for openers.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, now, look, before we get into anything else, somewhere between the anticipation of your now your granddaughter, baby girl,
yes,
you must have given some thought to how you would like to be referred to. You know, is it nanny? Is it grandma? Is it you wouldn't want your first grandchild to be saying, "Hey, Christine, Chris."
No, I want her to call me Mamo, which is the traditional Irish word for grandmother. So Mamo, which I think is really nice.
Now, I'm learning something new this morning as well. Mamo? How do you spell it?
Yeah. M-A-M-O. So it's very simple.
Yeah. But nobody told me about that one before. But anyway, congratulations to you. There's the baby.
Thank you.
There's the baby's name. Is that... that's still in the hopper, is it?
It is. The baby came a month early. She took us all by surprise. So the name hasn't been decided. So, no, just little baby girl.
Okay, well, you know, Siobhan, your daughter, and husband Dave. And, of course, poor Uncle Kieran, or son Kieran. This is, he's got a new niece. A lot of things happening. And listen, again, congratulations.
Thank you.
You have been for decades an author, and not just an author, but considered to be a world-renowned author of books on the Irish famine, the Great Irish Hunger. You have, bring us to, first of all, your own growing up, your awareness. What got you to have such a, you know, a distinctive interest in that period to begin with? And then, the of course, the aftermath, and you've brought us right up to today, and in all of your writings and in your teaching at Quinnipiac University. What is it? Where did that motivation come from? Where were you born?
So, my family were Irish, but they, like so many people, left Ireland as a result of poverty. And unlike the majority of immigrants who ended up in North America, my family ended up in Liverpool. So I grew up in Liverpool, but very much within an Irish family. And growing up, I always felt Irish, but it was a time when being Irish in Britain wasn't too easy. In many ways, we had to be invisible. No St. Patrick's Day parade in Liverpool when I was growing up. But I always wanted to return to Ireland, and my parents instilled in me a great love of Ireland. And they also instilled in me, I suppose, a great sense of social justice. And I think the combination of those two things has really guided my work, my love of Ireland, my always believing I had been displaced and wondering why I wasn't born in Ireland. And then, you know, my parents' idea of social justice, and that led me to look at poverty and how governments respond to poverty, especially in relation to Irish workhouses. And then that led me to what we called in Ireland the Great Famine, more usually known here as the Great Hunger. And now more recently, I've been working on Irish abolition, particularly Frederick Douglass and his relationship with Ireland. But I think what brings all my work together is that idea of social justice and equality and, I suppose, identity.
Yeah, and indeed, whereas you've published extensively on the impact of the Great Irish Famine, the Great Irish Hunger, you've lectured on the relationship between poverty and famine in places like India and Spain, Canada, France, Finland, New Zealand. Could you just maybe spend a minute or two on the common theme? And again, you know, we jumped somewhat from the famine that we didn't want to talk about in the first place because, among other things, we have survivor guilt and we like to speak in our about Ireland in a very progressive way. Tell us about, again, the relationship between, the, you know, poverty and these countries, you know?
Yeah. So I'm particularly interested in Ireland and other countries that were part of the British Empire and which experienced famine. And famine is, I suppose, the most extreme form of poverty. But there's an Indian economist, Amartya Sen, and he argues that you never get famine in a democracy. And if that's the case, and it would seem to be the case, then what is it that brings about famines and extreme poverty and repeated periods of hunger? And really, it comes down to the way in which people are governed, the distribution of resources, and the way in which poverty is treated. And what's very clear in the 19th century, especially in these countries, but you could say in this society now to some extent, that poverty was seen as being the fault of the individual, and therefore people responded to it in a way that wasn't always most suitable to the needs of those who were poor. And this becomes more extreme in time of famine. And we know during the period 1845 and 1852, policies were introduced to allegedly help the Irish, that many of these policies actually were not in their best interest and exacerbated the hunger and the homelessness of the people. So what really binds people together is the way in which poverty is perceived and which those with power respond to it.
Having said that, let's just, during that period of devastation and hunger and death and poverty, was there an awareness with those who were at this point dying of starvation and hunger and, of course, of disease? Was there a hope? Was there somewhat of an awareness that something was being done or that goodwill was there to help them out, or did they read through what was happening?
Again, it's hard to get into the mind of people, and especially because the people who suffered most didn't leave any written record and they disappeared, essentially. They died. But what we know is, and again, my work on workhouses, the workhouse system was introduced to Ireland in 1838. And it was made deliberately cruel and harsh. And so people in Ireland, even though they were poor, didn't avail of it. And people only started to go in the workhouses at the end of 1846 when they were desperate. And mostly they went in to get a burial, not with any hope of survival. So there must have been a real sense of despair within the Irish countryside, within the Irish nation, really from the second failure of the potato in 1846.
Dr. Christine Keneally, the impact Well, let's just look. The impact, obviously, of the famine, the hunger, there wasn't that much time to set up plans of what to do next. What were the actions of the British government at that time? We know, of course, and many of us would say we have to go back 800 years to evaluate British oppression of the Irish. But did landlords, those who indeed ruled Ireland in whichever manner, did they kind of lay off at that point? Did they say, these peasants are eliminating themselves anyway, so there's no point in going in there making matters worse?
So that's a really big question, because we call it the Great Famine or the Great Hunger because of its longevity and its lethalness. It lasted for 7 years. And as those 7 years progress and the blight keeps coming back, the response of the British government changes. But essentially, 1845, which was a partial failure, Sir Robert Peel was the British Prime Minister, and he put in place a number of relief measures that had been tried and tested before and were pretty successful. He was out of power by the following summer and was replaced by Lord John Russell. And just as Lord John Russell is becoming Prime Minister, the blight reappears in Ireland. But it's far more virulent, far more widespread than in the previous year. And so people's resources are totally destroyed. And in the first year of famine, because Irish people were resilient and they were used to famines, famines were not new to them, but they never had lasted for more than 1 year. So 1845 to 46, people had slaughtered their pigs, sold them, pawned their shipping boats, pawned their wedding rings, whatever they had. But once they were gone, they were gone. So when the flight reappeared in 1846, it was far more serious. And that really marks the beginning of the famine and the beginning of mass mortality in Ireland. And what's tragic is that even though the problem facing the British government, who ruled Ireland from London at the time, at their insistence, the British government chose not to use its resources to help the Irish people, partly because they argued the people were poor because they were lazy, there were famines because the Irish people depended on potatoes, so they were stupid. And so 1846, the British government put in place a system of public works. And it was disastrous because people who were hungry just didn't have the resources to work 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, building useless roads and walls that surrounded nothing. And sadly, that winter was the coldest for 100 years. So people who pawned blankets and cloaks and shoes were now out in the snow, doing these useless works, working for minimum wages at a time when food prices were very high. So people started to die. So in the spring of 1847, the public works were closed down, and they were replaced by soup kitchens. And to me, this is very significant, because soup kitchens were just to be there for summer of 1847. It was the only time during the Great Hunger that the British government actually gave people what they needed, direct relief. But the soup kitchens were only to be there for a limited time. But by July 1847, over 3 million people out of 8 million people were being fed every day in the soup kitchens. But what this episode tells me, this very short-lived episode, is that the British government had the logistical, administrative, and resource capability of feeding all of the Irish people for the whole of the Great Hunger. But for ideological reasons, they chose not to do so. And then at the end of summer 1847, the British government said the famine was over and no more relief would come from Britain. But the Irish people, despite their colonial status, had to help themselves. And again, disastrous, because people continue to emigrate and people continue to die.
Christine, the Was it a coincidence that we took, you know, with many songs and stories and historic facts about the beginning of the official beginning of the of what turned out to be the worst disaster in Irish history? Was it a coincidence that England, that Britain chose that time to say, by the way, we're cutting you off now, you're on your own? That coupled, of course, with the fact that the Irish were primarily slaves anyway during that period. Does history record if this was intentional or what?
It was deliberate. It was very deliberate because after 1847, you see changes in attitudes. The workhouses, the Irish workhouses, become responsible for all relief, and they are financed by Irish taxpayers. So even though Ireland was part of the United Kingdom, had been forced into it in 1800, even though Ireland was part of this resource-rich British Empire, Ireland, at the time of her greatest need, was cast aside. So this was very deliberate. And so mortality continued to increase. Probably more people died in 1849 than actually in Black 47, proportionally. So the famine was not over.
The workhouses that we refer to and that you're describing to us, were they purpose-built? How was that selection made?
So workhouses, it was called the Poor Law, and that was introduced into Ireland in 1838.
The Poor Law,
The Poor Law. England and Wales and Scotland had had a Poor Law since the 16th century. But in the 1830s, there were various debates about the nature of poverty and why were people poor. And the conclusion was they were poor because they were lazy. So poverty was very much ascribed as the fault of the individual. So in England, Wales and Scotland, the Poor Law was modified, but it was still far more liberal than what was introduced to Ireland in 1838. So 1838, Poor Law was introduced to Ireland, and 130 workhouses were built throughout the island. But the workhouses were deliberately made so that they were to be very harsh institutions, very forbidding institutions, so that people wouldn't want to come in them. And if you did go in a workhouse, you had to go in as a family unit, but then you were split up. So man and wife were split up. Children, girls aged between 2 and 15, put in a separate area. Boys aged 2 and 15, a different area. And children under 2, separate from their parents, and put, again, in a different area. So it was a very, very harsh system. And the Irish people rejected it. Mm-hmm. Now, in England, Scotland and Wales, you could get relief in your homes if you were poor, but that was never allowed in Ireland. So from the outset, the Irish workhouses were much harsher than their counterparts in England, Wales and Scotland. And it tells you, again, British government's attitude towards Irish poverty, that Irish poverty should be treated much more harshly than poverty elsewhere in the United Kingdom.
You, as the founding director of Ireland's Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac University, did, as you introduced and as you took that the mantle, the responsibility for this Great Irish Hunger Institute, what were the initial reactions from your students, and did everybody rush into that? What was the motivation of the students, and were they more likely Irish Americans who might have shown up at your door to begin with?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, that's my dog crying. My dog's at my feet.
Oh, my God.
Coo. So I'm not giving him enough attention. So when I went to Quinnipiac, it was 2013, and since about 2000, our former president, John Leahy, had been acquiring artwork, sources, relating to the story of the Great Hunger and putting it in context. And that collection started out in the library, but it quickly outgrew the library. And so in 2012, President Leahy decided to open a Great Hunger Museum. And I was invited to the opening of that museum. And at that point, President Leahy said he'd love an institute, which rather than being a museum, which is off campus, would be on campus and very much grounded in the everyday life of the university. So I moved to Quinnipiac 2013 to found this institute with not much idea of what I was going to do, but I knew I wanted an Irish Studies minor. There wasn't one at Quinnipiac, but I wanted exhibitions that would showcase the great resources we have at Quinnipiac, not just the artwork, but other great resources relating to Irish history, and also conferences. So since I've been at Quinnipiac, we have conferences every 2 years that leads to a publication. We have a conference coming up in June. We've had six exhibitions. We've just opened one on James Hackshuke, an English Quaker. And I teach a course, various courses, but every fall I teach a course, Introduction to Irish Studies. And it is some Irish-American, but I think Irish history, Irish culture has a much wider appeal. And just this week, the course listing has opened for people to sign up, for students to sign up to Irish Studies in the fall. And within 2 hours, my course was full. And I've been hearing from students saying, please squeeze me in. So there is great interest in all things Irish. And the other thing we do at Quinnipiac is every spring, we send over 80 of our students to Cork University for a whole semester. And it's so popular, there has to be a lottery. And that predates me, that's been going on for about 14 years. So Quinnipiac's connections with Ireland are very strong, and with the Irish-American community here are really strong. So it's a very dynamic, exciting place to be because of all that we're doing.
There was a big event in Washington this week as Irish Ambassador Dan Mulhall at the Embassy of Ireland launched year two of the Great Irish Famine Voices Roadshow. First of all, what is the roadshow? How did it form? I'd say you'd be the best one to answer that.
Okay. So the roadshow, it was an idea of the people at Strokestown House, who are part of the Irish Heritage Trust. And Strokestown House, in 1994, opened a famine museum, probably the first, and now it is the National Famine Museum in Ireland. So I was a student, but I first visited Strokestown House in 1994 and struck up a friendship with the family. When I moved to Quinnipiac, we decided, because our interests collided so nicely, that we would actually have a partnership. So the Institute has a formal partnership with the people at Strokestown House and the National Famine Museum in Ireland. So they had this idea that wouldn't it be great to capture the stories of the Irish diaspora, especially their famine stories. And when we talk about the diaspora, we often think many people came to North America because of the Great Famine. And of course, 2 million people did. But as I like to emphasize, there were many famines in Ireland, both before 1845 and after 1852. And each of those resulted in a massive increase in immigration. So what the Famine Roadshow is doing is going to various locations, mostly with large Irish communities, and interviewing people on video and asking them what their personal individual stories are in terms of the coming to America, and also they're going to Canada later on, so coming to North America. And about 200 stories have been captured so far, and some of them are very moving. And it's an important work of recovery in terms of the historical record, but I also think it's quite cathartic for people who have these memories, and as you said earlier, have often kept silent, to now be able to tell their own stories. I think it's very validating. And it also brings our knowledge of emigration down to the individual level. Because so often this is joined, we say 1 million people died, 2 million people emigrated. And that really covers up the individual stories that make up this larger picture. So they're doing great work. The roadshow came to Washington. They were in Canton last week. They came to Washington this week. It was launched officially by the ambassador Monday night. I was teaching, so I didn't go Monday night, but they had a second night, so I was with them on Tuesday night and last week in Canton. And the roadshow is coming to Quinnipiac University on the 14th of June, so please come and tell your stories. So we'll be publicizing that. And it's free. Everybody's welcome. So it's a very, very powerful work of recovery.
Dr. Christine Keneally, I just wanted to ask you, though, about if you were to randomly pick Irish Americans and their the story of their ancestors and what the ancestors shared with them, or in many cases didn't share with them, is there a theme? Is there some particular aspect of immigration, say on the Great Hunger, the famine? Is that mixed in with a lot of other information and what makes each of us proud of our Irish ancestry? Are there a lot of people who say, yes, we were sat down as kids, we were told, we had, this was it? Or was most of, or did you find in research, and I know that our mutual friend, Earl McConnell, fingerprints are all over this one, but of people that were selected or videotaped or recorded or whatever, did many of them say, well, we didn't hear much at all about that, or it was in hushed tones, or we overheard the story, but as kids growing up in our household, the topic was taboo?
Yeah. Sadly, that's the case, that people say not much was said to them, and a lot of this is reading between the lines. We've even come across cases of people whose parents would speak Irish so that the children wouldn't really know too much. So again, that's part of the silences, and now that even that knowledge is being lost to us, and so it's very important to capture it now, because we often think, well, why didn't I ask my parents that question?
Yeah.
Why didn't I ask my grandparents? And then it's too late, because they are the people with that knowledge. But there was, and again, you said it very early on, Irish people, there was some early shame and some trauma about having to leave your own country. And mostly, because we know, mostly people left as a result of poverty. And so people sometimes try to forget that old life and create a new life. So there's so much that we have lost, but at least the Great Voices Roadshow is filling in some of these stories. We'll never be able to recapture them, but I think what it is doing is important. And important for the people to remember and to know that their individual story is important.
Is the purpose of the roadshow display, to expand on what you already have in your archives, or is it coupled with yet more invitations for people to add to your particular archive in this subject?
Yeah, I think it very much adds to it and augments it, because it is allowing people to speak for themselves, and it's people who might think that their story is of no significance, but everything adds up and gives us a more complete picture of the process of emigration and the process of being in a new country, being overwhelmed by it. And what really comes through, and this always strikes me about Irish America, and I'm so impressed by it, is that people who came and who had to leave Ireland, even if Ireland wasn't spoken about too much openly, people continued to love Ireland. And that's, I suppose, this one common theme. That's how much people loved Ireland. Even though they came to love their new country, they had that great capacity to love two countries. And I think that is something that's very Irish and very Irish-American. So I think if one theme comes through, it is that love for two countries.
Dr. Christine, can you give us a website? How do we get more? How do we get more information?
Okay, so the website's long and complicated, but if you want more information, just email IGHI, Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, at qu.edu. And we have a conference coming up in June on famines before 1845 and famines after 1852. And part of that, on the 14th of June, will include the road show. So we have a lot going on.
Thank you, as always. We're not going to, I know you mentioned Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac, but that will be a topic for another day. The Great Irish Famine Voices Roadshow, for those who might indeed want to, perhaps easier to remember, is the website greatfamineforces.ie, not .com, .ie. Christine, good luck, and again, you know, get your bib out there now. And
go and go, but I'm going to the hospital shortly. Yeah.
Okay, Mamo, so long.
Thank you,
Adrian. You're very welcome, indeed. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.